Welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable, your weekly reminder that most presidents and preemptive wars really suck. Brought to you by the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy post-Reason weekend, everyone!
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Howdy.
You guys are putting up a big front there. I know that you are more bedraggled than you sounded in that initial greetings, but we'll tease that out of you yet. Let's talk about Donald Trump. Over the weekend, former President Donald Trump announced on Truth Social, in all caps, that the far and away leading Republican candidate and former president of the United States of America will be arrested on Tuesday of next week. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, not a Bragg brother, as far as we know, has neither confirmed nor denied reports that an arrest is looming in the now six-year-old grand jury case involving hush money payments given by officials involved in Trump's presidential campaign to porn actress Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet about sexual relations she allegedly had with that man, Donald Trump. But Bragg and the various overlapping armies that occupy Lower Manhattan have been busy sending out defiant memos and erecting steel barricades. So it seems that some action in this case is indeed likely. It would be the first time a former American president is rung up on serious criminal charges, or semi-serious ones at least. In this case, it would be the felonious falsification of business records in an attempt to cover up a violation of federal campaign finance law. Trump's preemptive responses so far have included, but are not limited to, protests take our nation back, and they're killing our nation as we sit back and watch. We must save America. Protest, protest, protest. And can you imagine the great New York City Police Department, correctly referred to as New York City's finest, who for the first and only time in history endorsed a president, me, and honored me as man of the year, having to defend and protect the defunders and cop haters of the radical left that want to put their greatest champion and friend in prison for a crime that doesn't exist?
There's actually more to that one.
There's more to that one. I just got it.
Yeah.
The editing function.
It was the edited version.
Of Truth Social. We got to limit those characters. Catherine, is this prosecution a good idea? Wake up.
I mean, is this
prosecution
legally justified?
That's not
probably
what I said.
Yeah. That it seems right.
All
but,
right.
That's the beginning part of my answer. Give me a minute. But, Trump is trying to set up a hostage situation. He is trying to set up a situation where by doing this thing, we break our country's brains. And he wants to do that because that would be good for just him, maybe. And that's fine. Like, in all of these posts that he's making, the way that he directly identifies himself with America, which he's done for a long time in his tweets, but, you know, he's not even president anymore. Even presidents shouldn't directly identify themselves with America. Like, historically, that's been a good way to get yourself guillotined when, you know, you identify with the state. But I think it's a really dangerous moment. I wish that I could somehow poo-poo this. My deep instinct and desire is to say, like, this will all work out fine. But January 6th happened, and he clearly is trying to summon another January 6th caliber response out of the ether. And it's going to be really bad if he succeeds. I will say, are people protesting? Like, is there any... Nothing. No one's like.
Well, there are no charges
right
yet.
Now. Of course, nothing yet. At least as of this taping has happened. Yeah.
Nick, I'm not sure I heard an answer from Catherine, but let's be nice to her for now. Do you think this is a good idea? Do you think Trump should be above the law?
Which are you asking is a good idea, Matt?
Do you think
him being arrested or him?
The prosecution. Let's talk about the enforcement of the law in these United States against a would-be target of the police state.
Yeah. In general, I don't think it's a good idea to have a former president be arrested for much of anything unless he went on a crime jag, like if he started knocking off banks in South Florida or in New Jersey or wherever he's living most of the time now. I don't think it's a good idea. I think what he's actually doing is trying to forestall any kind of case against him by making it public and by raising the stakes and things like that, which I also don't think is a good idea. But I no, I don't think it's a good idea. And, you know, the things that he is apparently being charged with are, you know, anything having to do with campaign financed violations is basically bullshit and shouldn't be a crime. I don't understand, to be honest, why hush money is considered illegal, because Stormy Daniels could get paid by the National Enquirer or should get paid by Donald Trump. Who really cares? Having said all of that, for me, the enjoyment factor of this is that a lot of people during the Clinton years, when Clinton was being impeached, and his defenders would say, well, he was just lying about sex, and everybody lies about sex. And Republicans said, you know what? He is the president of the country. He's supposed to be held to a higher standard. He should be not just impeached, but put in jail. Now we are, you know, we have the inverse of that. It's the mirror episode of Star Trek, the original series, which was a terrible show. And this is a terrible show, Matt. I hope that answers your question.
To extend the analogy, the Starr investigation, Kenneth Starr investigation that ended up ringing up.
I believe it's better known as a witch trial, Matt, or an inquisition.
It was originally about Whitewater, right? Wasn't that like that was the whole idea? And then like 6 years later, we get to a blowjob. It has a similar thing too. This started off as a tax fraud investigation that has rung up some other things having to do with the Trump organization, and then this sideline came out, and for a while was decided discretionarily by the DA not to prosecute, especially in the wake of January 6th of 2021. Is like, oh, well, maybe this sounds kind of small in comparison to more serious charges that are being investigated down in Georgia having to do with the election and such like. Peter, one of the grossest parts of the rise of Donald Trump politically, in my estimation, was the perennial campaign rally greatest hit of lock her up chants by the crowd pointing to Hillary Clinton over the years. Isn't what we're seeing right now basically the Democratic version of lock him up, only this time it's actually backed by action?
Matt, thinking about this topic makes this an unhappy Monday for me. So I'm going to have to issue a retraction on my opening statement. I also just want to note, with regards to what Nick said, the case here isn't that hush money is illegal. Hush money is legal. You can just pay it privately. The case is that it is hush money paid and then hidden in an illegal way with the intent to influence an election. It's a campaign finance violation. But notably, the Federal Election Commission, which is, you know, in charge of overseeing campaign finance violations, has investigated this and decided, this doesn't seem like it's worth pursuing. They didn't quite say it's definitely not a crime. They didn't quite say we're totally exonerating him. That's not what they said. They just said, And that's how I feel about a lot of this, except for the fact that, as you said, Matt, that this is a fairly worrying escalation on both sides, I think. On the one hand, this is obviously a politically motivated case. I just don't see how you can treat it any other way. So I would point everybody here to the great libertarian legal scholar Wally Olson, who has written quite a bit about the cases against Donald Trump. Olson is, to radically understate things, not a fan of Donald Trump. Like me, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. And he, after watching the January 6th hearings last year, wrote a very strong and smartly argued piece for Cato's website that you can find at Cato right now, basically saying that the January 6th committee has in fact met the very high bar for prosecuting Donald Trump for his actions on January 6th and for sort of subverting democracy, not just with January 6th, but with this whole sort of push to sort of to overturn the election results. And Olson makes, I think, a very strong case. It might not convince every listener of this podcast, but it's a very good, very thoughtful, very strong case. And he has been tweeting about this as well, and saying basically prosecutors, I'll just read you one of his tweets. Prosecutors should not stretch the law in trying to make a campaign finance crime out of the Stormy Daniels stuff, especially since it is peripheral to Trump's most relevant misconduct, his attempts to subvert the integrity of the 2020 election. And he also argues that part of the reason he thought that the January 6th committee had met the high bar was that that's the sort of thing that you wouldn't that you might actually go after somebody in a normal circumstance, right? Like somebody who wasn't formally president for, like that this, I mean, although admittedly it would be difficult for somebody to do if they weren't formally president, but right, like part of the thing here is if you're going to prosecute a former president, one of the tests you need is would a district attorney go after a normal person for having done this same thing? And I think it's pretty clear that the district attorney would not be wasting time on this if the person weren't named Donald Trump and had not been in the Oval Office for 4 years. And that to me is a big part of what bothers me about the case against him. Of course, I'm also quite concerned about the calls for protests and for actions, for sort of crowd actions to protest this. Because as we saw on January 6th, people listen, and that stuff is dangerous. And this is just a worrying moment all around.
If I may, Matt, you know, one great thing we should remind ourselves that we're libertarians, and this is a great moment to be a libertarian because we are not invested in a specific outcome here. And I was saying, you know, back in the day, Republicans really wanted to get Clinton by any means necessary. Right now, Democrats want to get Trump by any means necessary. This, however this plays out, it's worth pointing out, like, we can live in a different world. And that different world is one that is sketched out, you know, in the pages of Reason and other libertarian institutions and things like that. Like, you really don't have to go with the turd sandwich or the giant douche. You can actually have people who are not embarrassments to humanity who are running either for office or running the government at any given point.
We'll see about that, Nick Gillespie, in 2024 on the presidential level at any rate. But Catherine, maybe to extend that point a little bit, both the choices afoot and other bits. I had referenced the Hillary Clinton kind of non-prosecution back in 2016, and we recall James Comey giving an anguished press conference about this all, in which he basically sketched out how she violated the letter of the law, and then why he wasn't going to prosecute. That actually, at least in my mind, it made sense according to the Suderman test of would you prosecute this normally, and chances are you wouldn't. Can you make a libertarian point to help Nick Gillespie or help prove Nick Gillespie's point?
Help the Republic, Matt.
Help the Republic
if we have one.
If we can keep it, about what happens when you have so many letters of the law to be violating all of the time and making all of these things a question of prosecutorial discretion.
Right. I mean, I think this is absolutely almost any prosecution, particularly one that touches a prominent national figure. You're right if you say this is political and politicized. Like, you're always going to be right about that. And that is because, as you say, Matt, we got too many laws, like too many notes. Like, it's just all those laws. I actually think, like, Nick's initial take of, by the way, I think we're like pro hush money and anti campaign finance law. So what the hell, man, is right. But we're mostly just we shouldn't be in a position where the people who are asked to make judgments about enforcing the law can choose any conclusion anytime. And that is just far, far, far too often the case that you can, in good conscience, give a press conference where you say, like, yeah, there might have been some law violating here, but we're going to let it go. And you can give you can take the same fact pattern in a different political context and say, yeah, we're going to prosecute this one. That's not how it should be. I mean, maybe it always is. Maybe this is the nature of, you know, human lawmaking and law enforcement. But we could be in a radically different place on the scale of the kind of complexity and consistency of enforcement on our laws. and everyone would be better off, right? Like, not just at the highest level of, you know, former and aspiring presidents, but also just like Joe Schmoes who are walking down the street breaking laws right and left that they don't even know about and just hoping that it's in nobody's kind of political or career advantage to come after them for it.
A couple of notes on that and other bits. There have been some interesting studies about the global rise of populism over the years. The Tony Blair Institute, of all weirdly named things, has published a couple of pretty good annual reports about this over the years. And one of the things that they find is that people who they define as populist, after they leave office, a just staggering number of them, and it doesn't matter if you are in what we used to call the third world or second world, developing world countries or democracies, get rung up, get charged criminally. This is part of the cycle of populism, and it's not a good cycle. And that speaks both to the underlying criminal conduct where it exists, underlying corruption where it exists, and I think it definitely exists with Donald Trump. But also of the knee-jerk response to it by people who are trying to lock him up or lock up the person who is their political enemy. It's really hard to get out of that. The other part that's hard to get out of is the Nick maybe can testify to my correctness here. You live in New York City and there's an election. It could be an election for governor. It could be mayor. It could be your city council person if you ever even get close to that level of campaign advertisements. Those have been for 5 or 6 years always about Trump. You know, when Cuomo was running for re-election, it was all about Trump. I'm going to stand up for Trump the hardest. And what happens when you make your local everythings about the president? Well, maybe the people who are being elected to office or appointed, I don't know, like in the Manhattan District Attorney's office, we'll see that this is part of what can keep them popular is to keep fighting against Trump. That's also a bad cycle. So a couple of bad cycles for all of us to reflect on. Let's go to our next topic here. Sorry to it sounds like I'm the one who's coming off a recent weekend here. This is to our ongoing banking crisis, which hasn't yet affected Donald Trump. Although I miss those Deutsche Bank days. Remember when like Deutsche Bank was going to like take down Trump? Once we get behind Deutsche Bank, we really know what's going on. We have an actual banking crisis in our hands right now. UBS, United Bank of Switzerland, over the weekend bought out troubled Credit Suisse, or should I say Debit Suisse, the Federal Reserve, speaking of boo, and five other leading central banks over the weekend announced coordinated action to boost liquidity in U.S. dollar swap arrangements, because apparently conspiracy theorists need more material. There have been all kinds of ratings downgrades of banks. People are waking up and realizing that when you jack up interest rates after they've been asleep for a decade, makes the climate for banking business a little bit different. Meanwhile, key lawmakers on Capitol Hill are talking about yanking up the FDIC depositor guarantee cap up from $250,000. Peter Suderman, your favorite senator, Elizabeth Warren, who's a member of the Senate Banking Committee, so congratulations, America, said about the FDIC cap on Face the Nation Sunday, quote, "This is a question we've got to work through. Is it 2 million? Is it 5 million? Is it 10 million? Small businesses need to be able to count on getting their money to make payroll to pay the utility bills." Peter, does that sound like a good idea or a great idea?
I'm glad Elizabeth Warren is finally standing up for the true heroes of America, the people with $10 million in the bank, right? Like they have not gotten their due in American politics. And, you know, all of this talk about millionaires and billionaires, like she's seeing the light. This is great. This is, I live for moments like this. So I think Elizabeth Warren is wrong about a lot of things, including and especially this. But I actually want to go back and I want to pinpoint, I think, another villain to a villain which Warren is like adjacent to, but not exactly one of them. And the villain here is all of the people who have been talking about modern monetary theory for the past decade or so, and influencing the Democratic Party's sense of fiscal responsibility or lack thereof, I think. Because what they've basically done is, even though the Democratic Party has not gone full MMT in the sense of Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden and the sort of top officials, you know, sort of the top elected leaders saying, oh, we're the party of MMT now. They don't say that. And every now and then they do say things like, oh, well, we have to pay attention to this, to the deficit here or there, right? Like, which MMTers sort of don't like in some cases. But the spirit of MMT, the idea that you could just kind of keep spending without real consequences, and that you didn't really need to look at or worry about deficit numbers, and that you could just shovel money at whatever you wanted to shovel money at any given time, is what led us here. Because the reason that these banks are collapsing, if we want to start today and trace back, the reason that these banks are having their troubles is because the Fed is raising interest rates. Well, why is the Fed raising interest rates? Because the economy is running hot, and there is, which means there is a lot of inflation. Why is there a lot of inflation? The reason there's a lot of inflation is because Trump, Biden, and Congress during the pandemic, the first year or so of the pandemic, spent about $6 trillion in pandemic relief spending. And that directly contributed to excess inflation in the economy. So the Fed is now responding to mistakes made during 2020 and 2021, fiscal policy mistakes that were made, again, not out of kind of slavish adherence to a core MMT ideology, not out of people saying, well, I'm MMTer now, we all are, but by people who had been influenced by the modern monetary ethos over the last decade, in which the spirit of that ran through the Democratic Party and basically gave them permission to just keep spending because they didn't worry about whether interest rates would ever go up, whether there would ever be inflation, whether this was ever going to be a problem. You know, the MMTers spent the last decade or so saying, well, we just don't have to worry about the bond vigilantes or the Fed or any of that. Or like, you know, it's just not that going to be that big a deal. We can fund whatever we want because we print our own money. Well, we printed our own money. We funded whatever we want. And now we're here. And Elizabeth Warren is like, maybe we should bail out the millionaires now. It's great.
I would add the phrase that was commonly uttered by, again, not MMTers, but just sort of like mainstream centrist left-leaning dullwits on Twitter. I was like, it'd be irresponsible not to borrow at these low interest rates. That's why we really need to have the government borrow more. Catherine, what is one commonly expressed dull-witted idea about our budding banking crisis, our toddler of a banking crisis, that is driving you particularly insane?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that we can just solve this problem by essentially saying you can never lose your money to anyone who has money, like, that just seems to be, like, a lot of people are very sincerely proposing that that's like a viable path forward. And it's like the whole way that our system works is that sometimes you lose your money. I mean, this is like there have to be people who take risks, and sometimes the risks are not socialized. And I don't, like, on some level, I you can hear me struggling because I'm almost out of words to try and explain that in a better way. Like, they're just all around me. There just seem to be people like, whoa, well, that was scary for a minute, but then we solved the problem. And we can just keep solving the problem over and over and over by any time that it looks like someone might lose money, we just say, nope, you didn't. And then they
Nick,
didn't.
You're too big to fail. What is...
Yeah, thank you, Matt.
I once
wore a t-shirt that said that very thing on CNBC.
That is, oh my God, that was on CNBC. That's fantastic. Was on with Larry Kudlow, I hope?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't remember. They're all the same, Matt. You know that.
I know you've been microdosing, but what is a specific thing that people have been saying or doing during this crisis that strikes you as particularly noteworthy for its ridiculousness?
Two quick things. One, people forget that Paul Volcker, the, you know, sainted head of the Federal Reserve who crushed inflation, under his tutelage, the federal funds rate more than doubled between June in 1980 and December 1980, among other things, helping Ronald Reagan to win what was called a landslide election because he jacked it up. This is how you squeeze inflation out of the economy. And everybody's for it until they're like, oh, that means that I'm going to lose some of my money or something like that. But that's, you know, this is what you do. But to me, the thing that is bugging me the most are the Silicon Valley people and like David Sachs, who is talking about, in particular, a member of the PayPal mafia and a fair weather capitalist. Who was saying that, you know, this bank, we needed to do it because otherwise it was going to, we would lose faith in all regional banks. You know, SVB was the 20th largest bank in the country. And he's saying, you know, if this was a bank filled with farmers' deposits, people would be like, how could you let the farmers fail? So you have to bail out people who are financing apps, you know, to buy slices of pizza or something out of Silicon Valley. And it's the reverse is true. Nobody in Silicon Valley, which is an incredibly politically connected, well-heeled, you know, powerful constituency, the only reason they care about a regional bank failing is because it was their fucking bank. And that just bugs the shit out of me because, you know, you're either a capitalist or you're not. And you either, you know, as Catherine is saying, you either recognize that you can lose your money or not. And that doesn't mean there isn't a lot of pain and a lot of good people and a lot of good ideas get wiped out. But it's like, please stop doing the special pleading, because that's how we get to a place where, you know, bank bailouts are supposed to be, at least after the financial crisis, are supposed to be for systemically important banks. SVB is certainly not that.
You know, I actually was thinking about that question, like, Nick, what you just said there about, like, well, they're well-connected. You know, the people who bank at this bank are well-connected. And it's interesting, right? Because the people, the users of Silicon Valley Bank are both absolutely well-connected elites who give lots of campaign donations and da-da-da-da. And also the central villains in our current political story, right? I mean, they're ruining America. The teen girls are sad because of the stuff that they're funding out of that bank. And I guess Donald Trump is probably the central villain of our political narrative still, but like second central bonus villain. And so it's sort of interesting to me that there wasn't any hesitation. Like that argument did not come up as far as I can recall. That first
in the
blush
30 minutes
of conversation,
between
like that first round, of like,
apparently, SVB is done, and
right.
Then Biden saying we'll bail
them out because it was so brief. I mean, it was so fast that actually the conversation around it maybe didn't even have time to evolve to second order considerations. But I can easily imagine this fueling Occupy Wall Street 4.0.
So you don't want to nationalize the teen girl sadness machines?
It would make them less efficient, right?
Like the fact that that really is a legitimate question, honestly, in Capitol Hill
My question is mostly about band naming nomenclature. Nick, would it be the teen girl sadness machine or the machines? Would you pluralize it? I think it's singular.
I think it's got to be singular.
Yeah. Okay.
Although Miami Sound Machine should be plural.
Yes. There's many sounds. And that's a tease for my... what we've been consuming for later on. So just keep that in your hat. I have
Gloria
Estefan
spinal x-rays, Matt.
I saw Gloria Estefan and I think the Miami Sound Machine on my high school graduation. They played on Tom Sawyer's Island in Disneyland. Fun fact. Here's my free advice to everyone.
Why did you escape from that reality, Matt?
I don't know. I ask myself that every day. It's a free advice. This is Matt Welch giving you advice to all of the listeners out there who have more than $250,000 in a single bank. Okay. So let's say you have $500,000 in a single bank. Here's my advice. Take out $250,000, withdraw it, and put it in another bank. That's my advice. It's free advice, straight up, because that's the insurance limit for the Federal Deposit Insurance Company, where they guarantee.
This is the most Matt Welch janky solution. It's not a solution to the problem I've ever heard
as a country.
Like, that's
it's
not
a solution to the problem of your own idiotic responsibility. If I have to listen to another David Sachs or other type of a-hole out here saying, hey, how are we supposed to know that the bank might be bad, that we put $500,000 in and that we wouldn't have this thing guaranteed by the federal government? How are we supposed to know? Because you're supposed to know. It's your money. That's the rule. Learn the rule. This is live it, learn it, love it, Nick. All right, we're going to get to our
thank you, Matt. That got through to me.
Something had to. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, self-reliance, right? Responsibility, thinking ahead. These are just a few of the values we try to inculcate here at the Reason Roundtable. If that hasn't been clear already, that is why it's so appropriate for us to tell you right now about the Air Medcare Network and how it can snatch a financial worry right off your plate. The Air Medcare Network is America's largest emergency air ambulance membership network. Their providers operate state-of-the-art helicopters, and their specially trained medical personnel provide the highest level of pre-hospital emergency medical care. You see, even with the seemingly robust health insurance policies you have, such flights can be astronomically expensive and at a moment when you're in no position to negotiate. But when you're a member of the Air Medcare Network, you won't see a bill for your flight when flown by a participating provider. That's the kind of financial safety net a self-reliant person can count on. Membership is amazingly affordable, only $99 per year. Just $79 for seniors, and it covers your entire household. But wait, listeners who act right now can get up to an $80 MasterCard or Amazon e-gift card when they join. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason. Use the offer code REASON and start enjoying peace of mind. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder, send your to-the-point queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Christine Parker, who writes in part, and this predates the Trump indictment news, to be sure. Here we go. I cannot shake the sense that our nation is unraveling. However, I want to be fair. We all had uncles who crowed that the country was going downhill when we were kids. But as I have gotten older, I find myself repeating a similar refrain. From here, most of what I can see is the instability of our economy, our toxic political culture and social discourse, the continuing mask wars, the rise of woke, the collapse of meaningful education, Newsom slapping Walgreens for refusing to break laws of other states, dogs and cats living together, her words, not mine, mass hysteria. I sometimes bounce between anger and hopelessness and will confess to feeling some fear about what's next. At the end of the day, we're a giant collection of humans, and there's no reason to think we won't fuck this up. Language, Christine. Even the forest looks pretty hideous with so many deformed trees. I would be grateful for your perspective on the prospects for our little American experiment. Are we actually headed for seriously bad shit? Again, Christine with the language. Or am I just one of the olds now? Catherine, you're familiar with the olds. What say you?
I think she's just one of the olds now. I think everybody always thinks that the world is ending sometime after they like are in their 20s. I don't know. A lot of things are still good. I know we do this refrain all the time, but we do it all the time because it's true. Life is easier and more interesting and richer and longer and healthier than it's ever been. And yes, politics are just absolute flaming garbage. And like sometimes the politics bonfire sends out little sparks. It looks bigger and scarier than usual, but the politics bonfire is just a small flaming dot on a beautiful landscape. I think the trees in the forest look pretty good. How was that for an answer, Matt Welsh? That was a metaphor.
It sounded like you almost believed it.
I do believe it. I really do believe it. I've chosen a life in which I stare directly at politics all the time. And so sometimes my eyes hurt, but it's good out there. Life is good. It's going to be okay.
Nick, she refrained cranky uncle. So I feel like you've been named here. Are you the man with the flaming pie? What say you?
Paul McCartney's terrible album at Flaming Groovy Pie.
It was called Flaming Pie. He used the man
Flaming,
with the flaming
pie, pie of Dog Too. And that's like 30 years old now.
It's actually not that bad. Re-listened to it recently. You're old, you're sad. What say you?
I'm not sad. I you know, this is To pick up on what Catherine was saying, you know, this is the issue, is that, you know, kind of freedom, liberty, progress moves forward, but not all at once. And it's oftentimes going, you know, in different directions. And when I think about the world that we live in now and the world that my kids, my adult children are moving into, it is manifestly a better world than the one that I grew up in, and certainly better than the one that my parents or grandparents grew up in. So I'm very happy about that. There are really serious issues with politics right now. I do think politics is worse than it was 30 years ago. And the idea, it's not clear that there's a resolution in the offing. You know, if as Lionel Trilling used to say, America is nothing if not dialectic. We have a thesis and an antithesis there, you know, where the synthesis is that formed in the late 90s and carried us through until 9/11. I don't see that happening. From a libertarian perspective, you know, the dream is always to get to a world beyond politics. And that, I think, is happening. But it is not because politics is letting it happen. You know, I think the discourse between Republicans and Democrats is awful. I think the spending on things, you know, just the actual budget, you know, that both parties tend to put forward. We are now in an era where $6 trillion is the minimum federal budget that we're going to be seeing for the rest of our lives. You know, that is mind numbing, and it's bad. It has really bad effects on long term economic growth. I think things like the insidious nature of kind of woke culture into schools and corporations is something that's serious and needs to be fought. I think that the countermeasures to that are just as bad. The solution to that is school choice, not by having a new boss tell you what you can and cannot read or think and things like that, or how you can do business. But overall, I'm excited. And the things that make me most excited are things that came online towards the end of last year. I mean, things like ChatGPT, DALL-E, and other kind of AI-generated image makers. I think people, you know, the rampant rise of drug decriminalization and a sense that politics is not going to fix what's wrong with us, so we need to get on and building all of our alternative worlds and seeing what we can learn from each other. I'm more optimistic now than I was a year ago, because I think, the funk on tech in general and other forms of innovation, I think, is lifting a little bit. So, Christine, stick with it.
Your last 90 seconds just made me really sad. Not only half sad. All right. But,
yeah.
Every time someone exercises ChatGPT on our Slack channels, I die another day. Peter, you're
just
dead
drink
inside.
Drink another and sure, Matt. And, yeah. You know.
I'm not wearing the right undergarments for that. Peter, what say you?
I want to focus on one little part of this question, which I think is a good question. So there's a bit in the middle of it that says, most of what I can see is the instability of our economy, our toxic political culture and social discourse, continuing mask wars, the rise of woke. And the first couple of words in that bit that I read are, most of what I can see. And I think something has actually changed in our politics and our technology and in the way we sort of organize society over the last 10 or 15 years, which is that social media has allowed us to see a lot of things that were previously largely hidden from public view. And in particular, a lot of political discourse that was probably happening, but not being recorded and not being sort of shared with the rest of the world. Social media also allows that to organize, and I think sometimes in good ways and sometimes in bad ways. But this is something that I think that people sort of need to sit with a little bit more, is that social media allows us to see all of this stuff. And social media makes it visible, and living online, as a lot of people kind of do now, makes it feel like this stuff is a greater threat and is happening a lot more than it used to be happening. And I think a lot of it is just the increasing visibility rather than an actual increase in this stuff, just a pure increase in it happening. I think a lot about a Time magazine article from, 7 or 8 years ago, about bombings in the 1970s. And that article had a crazy factoid that between 1971 and 1972, in a less than 2-year period, the FBI counted 2,500 bombings. So that's more than one a day. That's more than several a day. And yet they just sort of happened, you know, mostly at night. They didn't really kill many people in most cases. In most cases, they didn't kill anybody. The biggest one killed four people. Very bad, to be clear. That's not good. But people just sort of accepted it in part because, you know, the media environment, the discourse environment was different at that point. Can you imagine what Twitter would be like? What social media would be like in 2023 if there were four or five terrorist bombings a day, even if all they were doing was destroying, you know, some plumbing in the basement of a building that, right, and not really hurting anybody? It would be crazy making. It would be insane. We would feel like society is melting down. And that wouldn't even necessarily be totally unreasonable. And yet, that was happening in the early 1970s, and people just sort of went, well, you know what? It's a bunch of bombings. That's not great. No one loves that. But we understand that we are going to kind of, this is, things are a little rickety and we are going to get through this. And I think that that sort of perspective is useful here because we can see a lot more of this now in a way that we couldn't decades ago. And that is changing the way that it's changing how it feels to be alive and to be involved in political discourse, you know, in this decade, and making it different than it was in previous eras.
I would slightly amend Peter's excellent take there, only with that a lot of people did not feel like we were going to get through this in 1971 and 2 and 3.
Yeah, that's fair.
And 4.
And we did.
That there was a strong sense of apocalypticism. There was going to be mass starvation. You know, Richard Nixon was the ultimate fascist. And he was, you know, running the police state and bending it to his will. And you know what? There was some evidence for that. There's a lot of reasons to be apocalyptic then and perhaps now, too. My answer to the question kind of echoes some of the dread that both Nick and Catherine mentioned about our current political moment. I'm from California internally and externally, and I discovered for the first time kind of a broad sense of political less than optimism beginning in 2015 with the rise of Donald Trump, and also the kind of bipartisan apocalypticism that came up with that, the bipartisan denialism of long-term fiscal outlooks, and the kind of global nature of it all too, made me think that. And I think also in the wake of COVID, we have another kind of pig in a python situation that we don't fully understand, but it's certainly wreaking havoc on cities in America in particular, in ways that I think have a lot of resonance with the dark days of the 70s too. So there's a lot of reasons to be pessimistic, and I never stop remembering that I was born in 1968, which was a bad year, man. Like they just were assassinating everybody, and there were more people, more U.S. soldiers killed that year in Vietnam than have been killed in all of America's wars combined since then, which is an improvement. There's lots of things that are bad that are associated with our war making. We're on the 20th anniversary of the disastrous Iraq War. And my God, if I have to listen to another proponent of that try to defend it, holy cow, people, sit this one out, please. But all that said, I've been reading my mom's memoir about her childhood, thinking about aspects of childhood of in the 70s of Nick and I, when racism, you know, just brutal cop racism was front and center with a lot of where we were living in ways that are just unfathomable now, unthinkable. Things do improve, and we do get old and cranky. And our job is to not just transmit that crankiness, but to transmit what we know, if we think about it for more than 17 seconds, things that are so much better off for our kids now than they were for us. And to try to warn people about the cul-de-sacs they're turning into, but also not to lose perspective ourselves. And if all else fails, we get too pessimistic, as Nick pointed out, you could just, you know, there's a lot of free drugs out there right now. Just do them responsibly. Stephanie Slate would counsel all of us. Okay, let's go to not quite our end of the podcast. Let's go to a lightning round. We need that to steal Kennedy's tropical topical storm lightning sound? That
I don't think we do, Neil. Jack, whatever your name is, Matt.
Wow.
Sorry, Jack, Neil,
wow.
Matt.
Jack.
Yeah, now.
Oh, right. Wow, Grandpa, yeah. How you doing?
I spent a little too much time with Vernon Smith recently. It's sort of an off.
That's yeah. He's more cognizant.
No such thing.
Several.
First
of
all,
yeah.
Vernon Smith is still optimistic, yeah. And if
I had
he can
that bolo tie game,
can
maybe
be.
I'd be
I
a little bit more peppy myself.
It's so strong.
It could take
such
down
a
flock
game.
Of horses with that thing, Matt.
On Friday, the follically challenged former Rolling Stone journalist Matt Taibbi came out with yet another Twitter Files thread. Wow. But before you reach for that dial, people, listen to these startling details. Stanford University, which has been having a month. Holy cow, Stanford.
It's true.
Stanford, maybe
tough
sit,
times
maybe
over
sit
there.
Out a month too. Maybe like have a little retreat with yourself. Apparently started in May 2020, a thing called the Virality Project. That was the first strike. In its
another
own
good
word,
band name, Matt. The Virality Project. It's like a super group.
It's a pun. You get it? It's a virus.
It was intended to, quote,
pun.
Detect, analyze, and respond to incidents of COVID-19 vaccine disinformation across online ecosystems and ultimately mitigate the impact of narratives, which would otherwise undermine the public's confidence in the safety of these processes in the United States. Can't see where that might go wrong. That sounds like it's going to be fine. I highly recommend people read the whole Twitter Files thing from Taibbi in his phrasing this project when it was combined with the various social media companies and the very active collaboration with the federal government became a censorship machine, consciously suppressing even true information that might promote such undesirable ends as vaccine hesitancy. Catherine, what is the thing that jumped out at you from this latest reminder of the terrible world that we live in?
The term that jumped out at me was malinformation, which was, you know, we've already talked on this pod about how the distinction between misinformation and disinformation has already eroded down to nothing. Like, in theory, those can and should be different terms that have different uses. But when all of these terms just mean stuff that powerful people don't want to talk about, then the subtleties do disappear. Malinformation in this Twitter thread appears to be this category that they are trying to create of things that like maybe are true. But the true part is not important. What's important is, will people do bad things with the information? Or, I mean, not even bad, just like things deemed undesirable by the conventional wisdom, the highly changeable conventional wisdom of the moment on COVID. So malinformation, if that term gets wider use, I will weep bitter, bitter tears. And you know, in this case, it is things like campaigns against vaccine passports, inciting fear about mandatory immunizations and the promotion of vaccine exemption cards. That is neither mis nor dis nor malinformation. That's just a legitimate thing
to debate.
Yeah,
and vaccine passports suck, by the way. So, like, that's that malinformation? Yeah.
Just like real passports. Remember that minute when like libertarians were like, maybe we can just hold the line on actually all passports are bad? Like, they are, but it wasn't the right PR move. Anyway, lots of things in this whole thread that are just legitimate topics of debate. And that's all they were. They were like absolutely the stuff of protected discourse around politics. And this label malinformation just really stuck with me because
Nick, I know your mind is already going to Mal Evans, and I'm just going to say stop it.
Now, I was actually going to troll the boss and say I thought this was supposed to be a lightning round.
That's also true.
Careful there, glass house dweller.
Nick, give us
rocks.
A bolt of thunder from Mount Gillespie.
Yeah, no, it was the emphasis that true information, like true words and emails that were garnered through the Freedom of Information Act, were somehow part of a sinister plot to reveal what officials were thinking to the American public. That tells you most of what you need to know about the Stanford Virality Project. And props to Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger at the Free Press and other people who are continuing with the Twitter files, because there's a lot in there that we should all be paying attention to.
And Ravi Suave at the Facebook files, let us not forget. Peter, what jumped out at you?
What's remarkable about this is that it was a project intended to stop vaccine hesitancy. But the sort of reporting that Taibbi did on this, on the Virality Project, would almost certainly have been flagged as mal or dis or misinformation, because Taibbi's story is true, but it could fuel vaccine hesitancy, right? Because what Taibbi shows in this is that pro-vaccine digital info busybodies were suppressing true information and true facts about the vaccine. And it seems just intuitively obvious to me. I mean, we could do case studies on this sort of thing as well, but that the revelation that pro-vaccine academics worked with the sort of the middlemen of digital speech to suppress true information, that's going to lead to skepticism about the vaccines. That's going to lead to conspiracy theories, and that's going to lead to vaccine hesitancy, and that's bad. And so, like, in a lot of ways, this is, forget all of the reasons this is bad from a pro-free speech perspective, though it is. This is just bad for the thing they wanted to do. This was an attempt by academics to suppress public discourse in the name of promoting a political narrative. It was a propaganda campaign. And while you can overstate its effects, you know, this wasn't a direct federal shutdown of speech under, you know, threat of going to jail. You shouldn't understate them either. This was a project that included efforts to prevent people from sharing true facts and information. And that's just totally antithetical to the way we discover and settle on knowledge. Like, knowledge is a process of opposition and debate and argument. And the way we figure out what's true in the world is by letting people share their opinions, share true facts in particular about what is going on, and then have and then fight it out. And this was the idea here is, oh, we couldn't have any debate. We couldn't have any argument. We couldn't have people sharing things that are true because that might go against the political narrative. It's a propaganda campaign. It's incredibly disturbing.
I think we need a complete and total shutdown of Stanford until we can figure out what's going on.
Until we know more.
Matt, before you go into your lightning round, I just want to point out this. You are the worst lightning round keeper ever. This is the long count.
Let's save the cheap seats heckling for our own podcasts, Nick. Let's go to our end of podcast. My lightning round.
What was your lightning round thing, Matt? Come on.
Why don't you let me moderate this one, pal? Let's go to our end of
that would be a nice idea.
What we've been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you start off?
Sure. I am reading Bottoms Up and the Devil Laughs, A Journey Through the Deep State, which is by former Reason staffer Kerry Howley. And it talks a lot about her reporting and exposés dealing with Reality Winner. But it's a lot of other people, both big and small topics. It's a fantastic book of what it's like to live in America in a kind of post-privacy world. I highly recommend it. It technically goes on sale tomorrow.
We've got a nice little excerpt from that book in the next issue of the magazine as well, if you want to get a tasty taste.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I consumed the Bragg Brothers movie Pinball, which came out this weekend. It's in some movie theaters. It's on the streaming services. This is Reason's own Bragg Brothers, who took a little leave to put this movie together. It is called Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game. It is about how there was a ban on pinball because it was the game of chance, and the people who fought that ban. And I just want to give you somebody else's review, The New Yorker, which said that it is better than all 10 of the Best Picture nominees, and 2023 will be a fine year in movies if there are 5 better lead performances than Feist's or 5 better original screenplays. The New Yorker said that about our boys. We're very proud of them, and you should stream or go see this very libertarian and delightful film.
There's also a really nice write-up in the Christian Science Monitor feature about it as well that I recommend people go seek out. Terrific movie. I can't recommend it higher. And congratulations. And again, no relations to Alvin. as far as we know.
But they will be staging a citizen's arrest on Donald Trump next Tuesday.
I would,
if only know, if Austin, that's the world I want to see.
Wow, Austin could do his like cop thing.
Oh, God, Andrew Heaton will be there somehow.
Oh no, Peter.
I watched the season finale to The Last of Us, the HBO adaptation of the video game. It's a post-apocalyptic video game set in a world, you know, sort of where zombies, they're not quite zombies, they're never really called that, and they're caused by a fungus, have taken over the planet. There's just a bunch of libertarian themes in the game and the show throughout. The show follows the story of the game really quite closely. So you see, for example, that there is an organization called FEDRA, which is basically the remnants of the U.S. government in disaster response form. And it's just an incredibly authoritarian, sort of awful, you know, kind of overbearing, militaristic and corrupt government system. And then you see the show in some ways even makes this more clear than the game does, I think. Like, throughout this game, you see, and throughout the story, you see collectives that have come together and to basically to suppress the individual desire to live and to say, oh, your life doesn't matter when the collective is at risk. And then at the very end of the first game and the first season, you come to one of the most fascinating moral choices that I have seen in pop culture in the last couple of decades. I mean, really just a kind of stunning ending that stuck with me for a long time after I played the game, and then I think was presented very powerfully in the show as well. Where the story is about a guy who it lost his biological daughter at the very beginning of the zombie takeover, and then decades later it has to usher a young woman who is about the same age as his daughter, maybe a little older, across the country because she seems to be immune to the fungal zombie infection. And so the idea is he's going to take her to a rebel group, an anti-government group of radical protesters who are trying to end the disease and solve this problem. But they get there, and here's some big spoilers. Some big spoilers for people who don't want to know how it ends. They get there, and it turns out... I see Catherine is taking off her headphones. They get there and it turns out that they're going to have to kill the little girl to do this. And it's not even necessarily guaranteed that they're actually going to come up with a cure. And so he does what surrogate fathers in video games do. He murders everyone. It's just a big murder spree because and the argument is
spoiler.
Yeah. And the argument is his responsibility was to himself and his loved ones. And not to a chance that the community might benefit, not to society at large. And it's not necessarily, I say argument, it's not necessarily a sort of you only have responsibility to yourself, like very strong position, but it presents this story in a way that allows us to understand that's at least reasonable. That doesn't make you a monster. It doesn't make you somebody who hates society. Instead, it makes you somebody who loves the people who matter to you and who is trying to survive. And that's what we're all trying to do. And what we need to do is figure out a good way to do that together.
Catherine, you can put your headphones on.
The speed with which I ripped my headphones off of my head when Suderman started saying spoilers. I hope everyone else who didn't want to get spoiled.
I want to, Matt, you owe me $15 now because he went longer than you than we bet.
We didn't bet.
Okay.
Catherine, keep your headphones on because this is a sports ball. One that you might find interesting because it's filled with non-sports related international drama, communism and capitalism and such. So last night was the semifinal of the World Baseball Classic, which is...
Oh no, I'm already asleep.
I'm with you on this one, Catherine. I'm grabbing the left side of the bed for this one.
This is a tournament that's been going on the last 20 years, the fifth time it's come around. And the semifinal was between the United States and America. That's the national pastime as well. And Cuba, okay? Right? So this is already good drama. And because Cuba's capitalist, or communist, and we're capitalist. The Cuban team, for the first time ever, had some players on it who had defected to America. Before, as soon as you would defect from Cuba, you were a traitor forever, and you couldn't play. So there's a reunited team somewhat, at least a couple of players in the team, and the game was played in Miami. Okay, so you got U.S. versus Cuba in Miami. The crowd is divided. There are people like holding banners. You have Marco Rubio complaining on Twitter that they're being censored, that they can't bring in their signs, Patria y Vida, on their shirts and whatever, but they smuggle them in anyways. The game is stopped several times because people are running on the field saying Libertad. It's like bananas. It's crazy. And almost none of this was shown on the Fox telecast. It is the worst telecast I have probably ever seen in watching baseball. All of this drama is happening and you have no idea why. Why is this player on the Cuban team being just lustily booed and everyone else is being cheered? They didn't explain. Well, it's because it was one of the players who had defected but refused to ever say anything bad about the Castro regime, and the Cuban authorities only let on players who never said anything bad about the Castro regime. And so the Miami audience was all split about this. There were people dragged away, yelling and screaming. They found like a commie apparatchiks in the audience. And so the exiles would find them, they'd point them, and they would yell Libertad at them. And they're these big, it was incredibly fun, and almost none of it was shown. Instead, the idiot color commentator on the game, John Smoltz, Hall of Fame pitcher. It was a blowout game, in fairness. But usually in a blowout game, that's when you do the storylines. And this game had nothing but storylines. Fantastic, interesting storylines. And he was talking about like what area codes the line score was made. Oh, that one's for Rochester. Incredibly bad. It was the worst thing I've ever seen. The glory of international competition, as Nick Gillespie well knows, is that you really want a lot of ridiculous nationalist political communism versus non-communism drama. That's the point. This is what we like. And they screwed it all up. But the World Baseball Classic itself has been fantastic. Japan plays Mexico tonight, including a Cuban guy who refused to play in the Cuban team. He plays in the Mexican team, and he's been awesome, named Randy Arozarena. But anyways, it's great. You should watch it. It was really good. And Fox really sucks. Really, really sucks. All right. That's all of the potty mouth that we have time for here on this Reason Roundtable podcast. Nick, do you have any events that you would like to talk about upcoming in New York, in addition to the we will give you information one of these days live Reason Roundtable a performance that might be happening at the end of April somewhere in New York City? Nick, what say you?
April 3rd, we're having Reason Speakeasy at the Blue Building in Midtown Manhattan, featuring John Tomasi and Matt Swolinski talking about their new book, The Individualists, which is an intellectual history of the libertarian movement. It's good stuff. Go to reason.com/events for details and to buy tickets.
See all of our podcasts and listen to them too. Why not? At reason.com podcasts. Donate to us if you like what we do. Reason.com donate. I'll catch you next week. Thanks. Bye.
Tonight at 11.